Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is, you know, basically when you want to download it and put it on your computer or your iPod or whatever. Today we've got a great show as we jump on the bandwagon of the blogosphere and do a show on the fairly recent hot opinion from Judge Shindlin, which is referred to as the Pension Committee opinion on proper litigation hold processes. The minute I read the opinion, I knew my friend John Jablonski would be all over it since he blogs about legal holds and has written a book on the topic. I ran into John at Legal Tech. We agreed to do this show on this opinion and talk about why it's so important. John Jablonski is a partner with Goldberg Segala, LLP, up in Buffalo, and he's co-author of Seven Steps for Legal Holds of ESI and Other Documents. He's an experienced trial lawyer, consults with Fortune 500 companies about records management, retention schedules, legal hold policies and procedures, pre-litigation planning, and electronic discovery. John also is a frequent author in publications and a speaker on records management, legal holds, and e-discovery. He's also the editor of www.legalholds.typepad.com, which is a blog devoted to current document preservation trends. John also appeared on an ESI Bytes podcast last May in 2009, covered seven effective tips for legal holds on our show. John, thanks for joining us again today.
John, I'm happy to be here. Always happy to help your listeners learn about legal holds.
And before we start, you know, since you're up in Buffalo and I'm in Pittsburgh, who gets more snow?
Well, it's funny. We're actually kind of having a mild winter this year, despite the rest of the country getting walloped with snow. I think the jet stream has socked everyone else with snow, and I'm knocking on wood now.
I got 30 inches in my backyard. The deer, I almost want to send out rescue people to help them get through my backyard.
And I live in the snow belt, and I have about 4 inches. So I guess you win, Carl.
All right. Well, let's jump into the topic. This was a fairly complicated case with 96 plaintiffs who were generally sophisticated investing companies, and they were suing two hedge funds they'd invested in when they went south on them, and they lost the collective $550 million. At the heart of the issue is the preservation efforts or lack of efforts undertaken by the plaintiffs in the case. First, can you give sort of a brief sort of factual overview of the case?
Sure. I mean, by way of short answer for the listeners, factually it may seem a little complicated, and actually the opinion is, for a layperson, not very approachable at, I think it's 89 pages long, 251 footnotes. So why anyone would wade into it when they can listen to your show for free is beyond me. But if you do actually go through and read it, you'll learn that while factually it may be a little bit complicated, from a legal holds perspective, it's got a very clear message, and that is you must issue a written litigation hold, you must enforce your litigation hold, and you must not leave implementation of legal holds to people that don't really know much about the case, the key players, or the IT infrastructure of the organization. And so what was interesting about this case is, from a historical perspective, Judge Shindlin is the same judge that issued the Zubelake series of opinions. And Zubelake 4 from 2003 is really the seminal case on legal holds in the United States. And a lot of what the judge talked about is what was actually incorporated into the advisory committee notes for the ESI amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in 2006. And now you have the same judge that gave the Zubelake decisions that everyone in the country cites, revisiting the legal hold issue now in 2010, and it covers a fact pattern from 2003 to the present. So she's able then to use that fact pattern as a teaching tool on legal holds, and she literally, you know, schools the attorneys involved and sanctions them, their clients, that is. So she takes from the trigger event of 2003, goes through 2003, where it was filed in the Southern District of Florida, a hedge fund basically went under, declared bankruptcy, and then an action was filed by the large group of plaintiffs, 96 plaintiffs, and then it was transferred from the Southern District of Florida to the Southern District of New York before Judge Scheindlin. So she says in her opinion that prior to 2003, her Zubelake 4 decision, and 2004, Zubelake 5, when the case was in the Southern District of Florida, there would be no notice that there was a duty to issue a written litigation hold in the United States, or certainly in the Southern District of Florida. But when the case was transferred to New York, she says that clearly they should have known after reading Zubelake 4 that they had a duty to issue a written litigation hold. And if I give them the benefit of the doubt, certainly after 2004 when Zubelake 5 came out, they should have known that they had to issue a written litigation hold. The plaintiffs in this particular case, and 13 of them were targeted for sanctions motions. Those 13 plaintiffs did not issue written litigation holds until 2007. And then the case basically analyzes what was done to implement a litigation hold back in 2007, and what the plaintiffs claimed was a litigation hold back in 2003, 2004, which turns out, and we'll talk about it, which turned out not to be a litigation hold, and that the judge then used all of that factual scenario to sanction the parties. I think it's interesting to point out that the actions of the 13 plaintiffs in this particular case in their failure to meet their litigation hold duties aren't particularly egregious, and they are, from my perspective as a practitioner, fairly typical. And we'll go into them in detail, but just as a snippet.
Yeah, what were the major flaws? I mean, let's jump right into their flaws. That caused the judge to be so concerned.
Sure. Well, you know, I think let's talk about the flaws, and then we'll follow up with some of the lessons. The first flaw was that a litigation hold wasn't issued until 2007, and then I would say that flaw was compounded by the plaintiff's attorneys trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, meaning they attached as exhibits a series of emails and memorandum that they sent out to the plaintiffs in 2003, basically soliciting relevant information for use in developing their complaint against the folks that they thought they would be able to try and recover money from for the hedge fund going under. So they told the court, hey, you know, Judge, we did send out a legal hold memorandum. We sent it out in 2003, and then around the time that you feel that there was a trigger event, we had a duty to preserve evidence, and see, it's attached as Exhibit A, let's say, hypothetically. Well, the judge then went and looked through the purported legal hold memorandum, and probably within about 5 seconds realized that it was not a legal hold memorandum at all, that it was an email to the clients looking for documents to help draft the complaint. So she spent a lot of time in the decision saying, hey, this was not a legal hold memorandum because it failed to include a admonishment that you must preserve records and other documents, including electronically stored information. It didn't go to all the people that should have gotten it. There was no follow-up. She goes through the whole steps of the legal hold process that she literally articulated in the Zubelake 4 decision, and she just laid those principles out and went through each one of them and demonstrated how the plaintiffs failed to follow those. In addition to failing to issue a written litigation hold, the court ordered the plaintiffs to file declarations of the steps that they did to preserve documents. And then the plaintiffs filed declarations where they had corporate representatives saying, you know, we searched everywhere and we looked for everything and we've given the other side everything that we found. And as the case goes on, we learn that those declarations were either less than truthful or ill-advised if you're on the side of the corporations, because I would never advocate a declaration of we've looked for everything everywhere and this is what we found. I mean, it's generally impossible to look for everything everywhere, but that's a practical tip.
Well, my sense is this is one area where a lawyer not conversant in electronic discovery can get themselves and their clients in a lot of trouble quickly. I mean, as we've said, this pension committee opinion seems almost Zubalay-ish. It starts with how outside counsel directs their clients, which there's an easy way to remember that, three C's. You got to communicate, you got to coordinate, then you got to comply. Do you agree that outside lawyers have to be managing these projects at the outset or problems can occur very quickly?
Well, I think the role of the outside counsel is to, in a very meaningful way, have a very serious discussion with their client about the client's preservation duties, about the scope of their duties, about what needs to be done to issue a proper litigation hold, what needs to be done to enforce a proper litigation hold, so that the client, either through in-house counsel, can act through the steps of a effective litigation hold and do it in a defensible way so that it can be proved to the court that reasonable efforts were taken to preserve ESI and other documents, or give the client an opportunity to get outside counsel involved in every step of the process. But, you know, that's your communication C right there. And then the compliance C, someone with knowledge of the case, someone with knowledge of litigation hold requirements, someone with a technical knowledge, as you mentioned, e-discovery, someone that can ask the right questions in a custodial questionnaire and follow-up interview with custodians and really tease out from people what their practices are. I do custodial interviews all the time, and what's interesting is there's a certain tactic to it to get the person that you're interviewing to kind of open up. They certainly understand certain corporate policies about I'm not supposed to save things at home. I'm not supposed to put things on my thumb drive. I'm not supposed to take stuff out of the office. I'm not supposed to email myself things at my Yahoo account so I can work on them from my hotel room because my laptop's not working or something like that. They certainly understand that. But from a litigation perspective, and this is maybe a good time to interject, a litigation hold, the sole purpose of it is for the purposes of litigation and to help the company, a company or corporation, defend itself in the course of litigation. And you're trying to develop a process that merely demonstrates to the court that you've done what you're supposed to do to discharge your duty, and you've done it in a way that is easy to follow, paints the corporation in the best light of taking reasonable actions to enforce the hold. So as a lawyer, I want the witnesses to be able to testify that they received the litigation hold notice, that someone followed up with them, that they maybe identified different areas to look for ESI or identified additional people, that they then received an amended hold notice, and that continued until it appeared that all of the folks involved in the case had been contacted. And then they received quarterly reminders, and then lawyers talked to them shortly before the deposition, and then they were deposed. I mean, that's the end game. And so you're working back to trying to discharge your duty. So when you're talking to these witnesses after they receive the litigation hold notice and you're doing the key custodian interview as required by Zubalay and as required by a pension committee now, you need to get to impress upon them that if they testify that they do store stuff at home, that their home computer is now relevant. And what you're really doing is an effective investigation for where every place ESI may be stored at the corporation. And if you happen to have a data map or a records management tool identifying various locations and who the custodians are, great. But really what Zubalay and now Pension Committee stands for is you have to have boots on the ground talking to individuals and vetting out the rocks that you need to look under, as painful as that process may sound. If a case has significant exposure and warrants it, you really need to dot your I's and cross your T's. And I know I've been talking for a while.
No, that's a you know, and there's a good point in there that I don't want to be lost, and it's the communication issue of how important it is to really make who your audience is, if it's someone collecting their own data, understand why they're doing it in plain English.
Well, that's right, and through the pension committee decision, basically, an interesting kind of wrinkle that I haven't seen as a trend, and certainly, as you know, for some strange reason, legal holds have become my passion, and I follow legal hold decisions as they issue across the country. And there hasn't really been a trend that has required.
John, this is the right audience for you. If you were at a Buffalo Bill game, you might not want to lead with that. But here, this is great.
That's right. I might get my pocket protector ripped out and hit over the head with it. The trend, there's not really a trend that requires a collection as part of a legal and effective defensible legal hold process. I mean, there's some individuals and commentators that would say you need to do a collection, but there hasn't really been a case that talks about collection. If you preserve in place, meaning all the custodians maintain their own ESI until the case is over, the court doesn't really care so long as people aren't destroying it. There hasn't been a duty to do a collection. What was interesting here is the judge almost went as far as saying that you have a duty to collect the ESI, and some vendors, I'm sure, will read into it that there is a duty to collect the ESI as part of the legal hold process. But if you read it very, very carefully, what she was saying is that this the series of memorandums that went out that were purported to be litigation hold notices, and then the follow-up that was done, some individuals were allowed to identify relevant material on their own and forward it to their counsel on their own without input from counsel. And if they had preserved everything else on their laptop or their hard drive so that someone else later could come by and do a keyword search or something like that, I don't think it would have been an issue. But because the plaintiff's attorneys are trying to put this square peg into the round hole, the court then kind of had a bit of an aside on this collection process, and that no one from a law firm really went and looked at a file folder and then made a determination that the materials being preserved or collected and sent to counsel as a method of preservation, no one really was managing that process. And that gets back to a key component of actual legal hold case law, is that you need to have the scope well-defined within a written litigation hold notice so that you're giving your clients, key custodians, and custodians who receive the litigation hold notice, basically a roadmap to what they're supposed to be preserving. And if you understand that and get that process, it makes it a lot easier to implement. So you're drafting a roadmap, giving it to people, telling them specifically what they're supposed to be preserving. For example, if it's a contract case, I need the contract documents, I need correspondence, I need performance documents, etc., so that they know what they're supposed to get. And then as you're doing the follow-up interviews with the key custodians, you're finding out whether or not what you developed as an initial roadmap was adequate. And if you're missing a key database and the custodian for that database, and you learn that during the investigative process, then you add it. And actually, that's a good segue to another part of the case. When we talked initially about the e-discovery violations or the litigation hold violations, they are not so egregious as you would read it and say, holy cow, this is shocking. It's things like 20 witnesses were identified, and they only followed up with 3 of those 20 witnesses from that particular organization. So the court said, well, you really needed to follow up with all 20. Well, in my practice, I see, as cases come across my desk, that's a fairly typical thing that happens during implementation of litigation hold. 28 custodians are identified, and for whatever reason, the client will only call 3 of the custodians and then may or may not amend their hold. Also, another failure was a lack of understanding of the IT infrastructure of the client. Specifically, there was a server in, I believe, France, and a server in London, and a search was only conducted on the server in I don't want to say France because of the French privacy laws, but let's say it was in Europe someplace. But a search was conducted, but not of the London server. So the court took issue. Well, how could you have an effective litigation hold if you knew people in your London office were working on this pension committee pension committee case and weren't actually searching for relevant documents for use in the litigation or for preservation purposes? And companies not identifying all the server locations where their custodians store their data is probably 90 out of 100 cases that probably happens in. And so for the court to call that out, it certainly is interesting.
Do you think Judge Scheinlein was speaking for many judges in this opinion who are frustrated by a poorly instituted legal hold? And as you say, I mean, some of these things are, you know, just not carrying the ball all the way across the end line. You've done some of the work, not all of it, so it doesn't rise even close to fraudulent. It's just poorly architected or implemented, might be negligent or gross negligent. I mean, do you think there was sort of a cry out in this opinion that, hey, look, you got to do a better job, everyone?
Well, I don't know that you could call it a cry out. I think you could maybe call it shouting from the rooftops on behalf of the judiciary. What's funny is you and I are both at Legal Tech, so of course all of the great legal technology minds get together and sit around the table all day and debate ESI points and then meet at receptions in the evening and debate ESI points even further, which is probably not a tremendous advertisement for Legal Tech if you're outside the e-discovery community.
But with a couple drinks, those discussions get even better.
Right. We start talking about metadata and terabytes and exabytes. So I'm really, our audience is really, I can just see how excited they're getting through the phone and through the podcast. So, but we digress.
Those people left us a long time ago. There are only e-discovery people on at this point. Trust me.
That's right. So here we are. I was telling a story at dinner at Legal Tech, and you know, Judge Pack issued a decision in the Acorn case about a year and a half prior to the pension committee case, saying that you have to have a written litigation hold, period, hands down. A verbal or no litigation hold, but everyone supposedly preserves everything, is good enough. And I constantly have a discussion with general counsel from corporations. They ask me, do I need a written litigation hold? And I say, well, you know, there's only a few cases that say you do, but I think it's a great idea, and this is why. And then I basically explain all the points that were raised in the pension committee before the pension committee case came out. If someone would have asked Judge Scheinlein 6 months ago, Judge, I read Zubelake. Do you think that the litigation hold that you're talking about has to be a written notice? Because a lot of what you talk about in Zubelake is actually following up with key custodians and kind of walking through the organization and going down to IT and making sure things are preserved and making sure there's compliance. I honestly believe that I think 6 months ago she probably would have said, as long as everything is properly preserved, I don't believe that you need a written litigation hold notice, so long as, you know, custodians were put on notice and you've done these other things. Maybe it's a small case, it doesn't warrant it. But now when she got pulled into the pension committee motions, and not only were there declarations filed, there were reams of motion papers, there were 30B6 depositions of all of these 13 witnesses that were found. There was plaintiffs trying to fit the square peg into the round hole of the litigation hold notice. She claimed in her opinion that it took her 300 hours to research and write the opinion, plus I don't know if that includes the hearings or not. So basically she had a morass of data to go through and arguments being made that what appeared to be true maybe wasn't true, and plaintiffs in their efforts to try and demonstrate that they discharged their duty may have stretched the truth a little bit. And she basically, her frustration level has now reached the level of many other judges in the judiciary, and I would like to think that she's saying in her opinion between the lines, I don't want to waste my time with a preservation motion. Preservation is pre-litigation or at litigation, and it should be done before the case comes across my desk for a motion. I want to see an audit trail. I want to look in camera and see that a written litigation hold notice went out on X date, that it went to these people, that someone called them and interviewed them, that you added a couple more people, that you added some server locations, that you preserved backup tapes if no active data is related to the key players, and you've done everything that I've talked about in Zubilee 4 and Zubilee 5 and pension committee, and I've now analyzed everything in 4 hours, and I can issue my opinion, and I can move on with the merits of the case. And so now she wants a written litigation hold, and I think that's a trend that will certainly spread across the country, where written litigation holds will just be a matter of course in litigation in federal and state court.
Do you think, now we talked about the amount of time she spent on this case with her clerk, the 300 hours just on this issue, and do you think the size of this case, that so many plaintiffs and the ability to poke holes through one production or the other, because it's almost like you're getting pieces of the puzzle from different plaintiffs, and it almost points out when someone has submitted a gap. Do you think that other judges in smaller cases are going to be, as inflamed by this issue?
I think so. And there's what you just mentioned is there's a couple of interesting points to be pulled out of that. One is with the ever-increasing effectiveness of the e-discovery tools that are available, the days of hiding the smoking gun in box 38 of a 200-box production in a complex litigation ended about 10 years ago. And to the extent that some practitioners still feel that, they're wary. They're like, these emails look bad. We have to figure out a way not to produce them to the other side. But you can't. Without a privilege, you have a duty to produce them. You can't hide behind them. Anybody who gets your ESI production is going to do keyword searches for what they want to know in your documents and find the smoking gun like in an hour. So you can't hide behind that. So here we have a sophisticated group of defendants that have 550 million reasons to go through plaintiff's document production, and they were very easily. You could probably talk to a few different types of programs that show parent-child relationships, that show email chain relationships, and they may even had a couple programs come to mind where there may have been a graphical view of the email chain cross-referencing all of the parties showing who was missing an email. So they found 311 missing emails. And by missing, it means the plaintiffs had all 311 emails, but from one plaintiff of the 13 plaintiffs that were the subject of these motions, they may have been missing 10 emails. From another plaintiff, they may have been missing 100 emails. All of these cross-referenced emails where one company was copied but didn't produce their copy of the email that another company produced. People are still following us. So that's pretty straightforward. The other problematic issue was there was a class of documents that the court said that the defendants argued, hey, there should be these due diligence documents that exist for these companies that were investing in the hedge fund. And we just know they should have existed from tangentially from some depositions, but we've never seen one piece of evidence related to these documents. No one has really testified that these documents existed. Everyone assumes they should have existed, but they don't exist. Because they don't exist, Judge, we want sanctions. The plaintiffs said, that's ridiculous, Judge. They don't have one shred of evidence, circumstantial or otherwise, that these due diligence documents would have existed. The Judge Scheinlin said, not so fast. I don't think it's ridiculous. I think they should have had due diligence documents. These were sophisticated companies investing in a $550 million hedge fund, so they should have something like that. And given all the other e-discovery, the legal hold violations, and the failure to produce the 311 emails as some evidence that bad things happened and a litigation hold wasn't implemented, I'm going to go with the defendants on this, and I'm going to say you don't have this class of documents. However, the judge didn't just gift that class of documents to the defendants. The judge said, based on all the evidence that you've gotten so far, you're going to have to demonstrate that the alleged missing documents were relevant and that your case was prejudiced by their disappearance before I will grant an adverse inference charge. But to me, representing corporations, I think anyone who's a listener from a company can think of a situation where a kind of standard operating procedure document wasn't created by someone at the organization for whatever reason. They were sick that day. They didn't think they needed it. Some innocent reason. But because plaintiffs may have persistent repeat litigation against the company, they'll say, hey, 5 years ago in this automobile case, products liability case, you gave us XYZ documents, and Z is missing from this document production. Based on pension committee, you must have failed to implement a litigation hold, so now I'm coming after you. So it's kind of a call out to me for one of the issues that companies really have to be concerned about and making sure they understand why certain documents don't exist in a case, and it's not a preservation failure. It's they just were never created in the first place.
Hey, one of the themes that started in that question was about the wasted time, the 300 hours spent. And do you think that wasted resources are going to become a buzzword in e-discovery this year? I mean, we both were at Legal Tech and saw Judge Grimm lecture the audience at the statistics show. We're not using the tools of meet and confer to deal with ESI, but we're still wasting lots of resources fighting through discovery. If the waste buzzer goes off in your head as an attorney, might you then be facing some more scrutiny on your tactics? And should you reconsider? You know, is there a more less wasteful way to do this? I mean, do you see that as a trend starting to emerge?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are happening. I mean, one with the cooperation proclamation that came out of Sedona and a number of judges citing it in their opinions, the courts are saying that we have to come up with a solution. And the problem is that there's this explosion of ESI, and I think you watched the same video that I did, which you probably have a link somewhere, but it's Did You Know for eDiscovery, and it has a lot of facts and figures in it, and the sheer volume of electronically stored information and the sheer fact that 89% or more of all documents created by corporations are created electronically, and probably less than 20% of those documents are printed to actual physical paper. So you have a vast majority of documents existing in an electronic world. And in the course of litigation, even kind of run-of-the-mill cases are being touched with maybe 1 gigabyte of data, which may be 4,000 documents or more, depending on the type of data. And I think there's a couple of camps that say, you know, we need to have a technology solution because it's getting too expensive. We need to, another camp says that, you know, the rules have to be changed to basically limit discovery and go back to the discovery system where parties ask questions of each other and they produce documents. Maybe let's go more like a magistrate system or a self-disclosure system where you have to disclose your relevant documents and the other side doesn't get to ask you questions. And then some other folks are looking for reform altogether to strengthen the pleading requirements so that relevancy can be more accurately determined rather than notice pleading where people are kind of looking for stuff with a shotgun. And then you have some judges like Judge Grimm, who you and I both spoke with him after the presentation that he gave, that they're a firm believer that if you follow the rules and you force the parties to cooperate and they actually cooperate and they actually have a meeting of the minds of what's really relevant and they certainly understand what the costs are involved and they work together and roll up their sleeves to get at the merits of the case despite the hurdle of ESI, that everyone is better served. And the other thing that's coming up is the Federal Rules Advisory Committee is meeting in May in Washington, and because of the e-discovery uproar since 2006 and some other issues, they're looking at a substantial rewrite potentially of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in an unprecedented way that hasn't been done in the last 60 years. And they're looking at a 3 to 5 year project, and this is the first step in that project.
You know, it almost mirrors the battle of the democracy in the United States, where are you better off with sort of a top-down approach, an approach with the rules being set out for everyone, or are you better with federalism where different parties experiment? And I tend to think these meet and confers, with being able to talk about what's working in those process and experimenting, is probably easier to experiment that way and improve than to have someone say this is the rule.
Right. Well, what's interesting to try and get us back on topic, if the listener's about to hit the mute button, is that the study that Judge Grimm cited when he was speaking at Legal Tech, which is from the Federal Judicial Center, they did a national case-based civil rules survey, and they surveyed, I don't know the exact number, but practitioners in hundreds, if not thousands, of cases that were closed, and asked them a series of questions about, was there electronically stored information in your case? Did you have a meet and confer conference? Did you have a Rule 16b conference with the judge? Did they issue a scheduling order, et cetera? Well, the number one issue that was discussed regarding ESI, with over 50% of the respondents reporting it, was preservation of electronically stored information. So if, in fact, a conference is held with a meet and confer and then with the court, the number one issue in all of those conferences is the efforts that were taken by a party to preserve evidence, electronically stored evidence related to the case, because there's so much that is at stake. If you do not issue a litigation hold properly, now it has to be in written form. If you don't send it to the right custodians, if you have custodians leave and you wipe out their hard drives and delete all their data. So it's just fraught with so much peril. And going back to the Did You Know video, which I know Ralph Losey extensively researched, there's a figure in there that only 20% of the organizations of the United States have a litigation hold policy. And with so much at risk in litigation, to not even have a litigation hold policy, not to have certain litigation hold procedures in place from when litigation was filed, you're in trouble. And you certainly have to anticipate litigation when people are emailing everyone 2 years before a case is ever filed. Wow, this explosion was huge. It's our fault. We're going to be sued. Well, guess what? You have a duty to implement a litigation hold at that time.
And I just would suggest people to I was going to try to pull up his address, but Ralph, Google Ralph Losey online and you'll get his blog, and that 6 minutes invested in looking at those statistics is well worth it if you're interested in e-discovery and why this is important. We've gone through a lot of the specifics of the case of what people did wrong. Let's just sort of wrap up in the area of the spoliation. The burden of proof that the alleging party has under pension and committee to prove spoliation. You talked a little bit about that, but if you want to sort of wrap up in this area, what are the remedies that someone could have in this area, and what is the burden of proof?
Well, I think the burden of proof is an exciting topic for some people. I would think most people listening to this don't find it exciting at all. The short answer on the burden of proof is Judge Scheinlin came up with a kind of a burden shifting test that she articulates, and it's probably something that you better understood by reading it. But basically, a proponent or a movant who believes the other side didn't properly preserve evidence moves and then demonstrates failure of the party to implement a litigation hold, or a failure to preserve because something's missing, and then the burden shifts to the opponent trying to oppose sanctions to demonstrate that they, in fact, either didn't have a duty to preserve, because if you don't have a duty to preserve and you destroy things, it's not material to the litigation, and it doesn't matter, you cannot be sanctioned. So you can demonstrate that you didn't have a duty to preserve, and then you can demonstrate that you have a reasonable excuse for why certain things are missing, and then that plays out as to whether or not the burden shifts back to the other party based on your conduct to demonstrate relevancy and prejudice. So that's that in a nutshell. If we do still have some time, what I would like to try and talk about is just one thought about the litigation hold process and what companies need to do to make sure that they implement litigation holds. I mean, I wrote a book, Seven Steps for Legal Holds of ESI and Other Documents, and I go through the seven steps, and there's another podcast that I would encourage people to listen to that talks about the seven steps. But the main purpose of a litigation hold, surprisingly enough, is for litigation, and we touched upon it briefly before. And I had a question a couple of weeks ago about, you know, now I have to develop this litigation hold process. It's going to be so painful, and what if people don't comply and they don't listen to the notice and they don't follow up, and it's just going to be so much effort, and aren't we better off without it? And I get those questions all the time. And my point is, when you learn of a potential case pre-litigation, or you learn of a case, a blind lawsuit after it's filed, and you're investigating it, you're the person tasked at your company with investigating it. You're calling individuals, which are the people that you believe are key, aka the key custodians. And you're talking to them about the case. They're likely sending you an email that contains some attached relevant documents, whether it be an investigation report, whether it be plans, whether it be copies of emails or correspondence. But you're having an interaction with these people, and because you're trying to figure out what's going on with the case. So you're doing this anyways. So why not, on a yellow piece of paper, keep track of who these people are, and then issue a blanket email with the reference line or the subject line, litigation hold notice, Smith v. Jones, and then say, thanks for talking to me today, or whatever you want to say, but I need you to preserve everything that you sent me, and here's a list of the things we talked about. And now you've got yourself a litigation hold program. And you've talked to key custodians, and you've sent them a notice, and then you follow up and just keep repeating those steps until you're all set, and you've protected yourself immensely, and really have done a good service for your organization.
Well, great. Hey, I know we're here at the end here, that there's a white paper on this if people want more information, which I found very interesting to read. Why don't you tell me about it? Where can you find it?
Sure. Basically, Judge Scheinlin was kind enough to issue her opinion about 2 weeks before Legal Tech. Perhaps the length of the opinion being 89 pages, she felt that no one would be able to besmirch her at Legal Tech because no one would be able to get through it and complain about it. But I was able to work on a white paper with a company called Legal Hold Pro. You can get it from their resource center at legalholdpro.com. There's also a link on my blog, which is the Legal Holds and Trigger Events blog, www.legalholds.typepad.com. What was great is the Legal Hold Pro people printed out copies of the pension committee opinion. I think it weighs in at about 16 pages of substance. They certainly don't promote their product in the white paper, so don't be afraid that they're going to come after you. It's what was nice about having the white paper at Legal Tech is people like Mike Arkfeld and Craig Ball and some other practitioners. Jason Barron went out of his way to come up and say something to me. People had really nice comments about it. And if you need to get through the 89-page opinion, you can get it. Interestingly enough, if you go to Amazon.com, Kindle Reader, you can download a copy of the white paper on the for your Kindle. So
I just got a Kindle. This will be great. I'm going to do that.
It's only 99 cents. I think it's a first. It's the only, if you go to Kindle and search for Legal Holds, it's the only actual paper on legal holds or book on legal holds that comes up. I'm going to have to work on getting my book into Kindle Reader, I guess. So it's exciting. And then the Legal Hold Pro people were kind enough to present me with the pen that's on the cover as a token of their appreciation for my hard work on the white paper. So that was kind of fun.
Great. Well, I will make up my first Kindle download, that says a lot about me. and too much, actually. But I appreciate you joining us. I also want to mention, we mentioned Laura Zubelake a couple of times in her opinion. She's going to do a podcast in a few weeks, and I might talk to her about legal holds a little bit as a side question. But thanks for joining us on another show, John. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year.
A lot of fun. Appreciate it. Anyone has follow-up questions, give Carl a call or give me a call, right?
Yep. No, that sounds great. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. That's ESIBYTES, or phonetically, Easy Bytes, where we attempt to put together an easily digestible list of shows across a range of discrete e-discovery topics. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.